Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials. In this, its third series, we will focus on conversations that treat the problem of the environment, climate change, and mass extinction. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. Dipesh Chakrabarty is Professor of History, South Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. In 2009, he published an influential essay, The Climate of History, Four Theses in Critical Inquiry. And in 2021, he built on this essay by publishing the book, The Climate of History in a Planetary Age. I have called this episode of Countersign, Provincializing the Anthropocene, partly as the phrase comes up in our discussion, but also in a nod to Dipesh Chakrabarty's very important book published in the year 2000, Provincializing Europe. At the heart of Provincializing Europe is a critique of historicism as a mode of thinking. Historicism assumes that in order to understand anything, it has to be seen as a unity and as a historical development. This makes it prone to developmental and progressive ideas of time and history, and to assume that phenomena have stable content, for example, the state, sovereignty, self-determination, and so on. Provincializing the Anthropocene is an apt way to characterize the key arguments of Chakrabarty's book, The Climate of History, for a number of reasons. Listeners of Countersign and others concerned with climate change and ecological catastrophes will be aware that the Anthropocene hypothesis is a means of characterizing anthropogenic or human-made transformations in the climate of the planet. Now, not everyone is taken with this Anthropocene thesis, and that is partly why I think the notion of provincializing the Anthropocene is a useful way to contend with some of the objections to the narrative that has been set forth in relation to anthropogenic climate change and the Anthropocene. In addition to the debates taking place among geologists themselves, there are at least two major objections. One is that the term Anthropocene, by making reference to anthropo or humans as a universal category, lays blame for climate change and ecological catastrophe on all humans, when in fact it is a minority of the world's population, largely in the global north, although not exclusively, given the impact of newly industrialized or large economies such as China, India, and Brazil, whose actions are transforming Earth systems and global climate. Another strand of this criticism is that by using the term Anthropocene, a vast array of racialized and imperial violence is sanitized through geological means, and thereby erasing what is an ongoing process of extracting materials and minerals, as well as marginalizing and decimating communities and cultures through an extractive process, the extraction of so-called natural resources to feed particular modes of production and economy. So it's not only a Marxist critique of capitalism, which, for instance, has suggested that the geological epoch we are referring to should be called the Capitalocene, but rather a rich, multifaceted critique based on histories of slavery, imperialism, and ongoing settler colonialism that is placed at the heart of objections to the Anthropocene thesis. In his book, The Climate of History, Chakrabarty acknowledges and discusses many of these objections. I am suggesting that he provincializes this Anthropocene debate by pointing out that it is imbued with an account of human time, when in fact we now have to consider the nature of planetary time. Just as Indian modernity could be coeval with European modernity, it wasn't the case that it was first in Europe and then elsewhere. There could be multiple categories and narratives in relation to the commencement of what is called the Anthropocene, or indeed the causes of anthropogenic climate change. For Chakrabarty, humanists now have to contend with being at the cusp of a move from human imagination of history to a planetary account of time that the human imagination will have difficulty contending with. Planetary geological time that involves the cosmos is indifferent to human time. The human history of the last 500, 5,000, or 50,000 years is infinitesimal and insignificant to the deep time that is situated with a planetary vision of time and history. What Chakrabarty has attempted is the creation of a new philosophical anthropology for a planetary age. But if it is a philosophical anthropology, that is to say that it concerns the anthropo, it must also account for a notion of the political. It must account for ethical relationships and problems of justice as they're presented in this moment of being in the cusp between the global and the planetary. So there is a new notion of the political that is called for, and perhaps understandably, Chakrabarty leaves it to others to flesh out what resolutions of political difference, of ethical relations, of justice and responsibility might mean. If being human involves the emotions and affective experience of hope and despair, what does hope and despair look like in planetary time? Part of what human justice does is address those who have been wronged, who make a claim for having been wronged. And perhaps the new idea of the political will have to involve more than human life and indeed non-life. But how will this be done if the scale of time, that is to say the scale in which a wrong may be experienced, is not even conceivable to humans? These are just some of the questions provoked by Dipesh Chakrabarty's really stimulating book, The Climate of History in a Planetary Age. Dipesh Chakrabarty, thank you for joining me on Countersign to discuss your book, The Climate of History in a Planetary Age. I thought it would be useful to set the scene for our discussion by recalling sense of bereavement that you refer to in the book. And it's a bereavement for the that follows the catastrophic fires.
That's true. The book started with in 2003 in Canberra.
In that context, you also reflect on your own sort of growing up in Calcutta, which made me think about my own childhood in Colombo in Sri Lanka, and how the encounter we have with nature is different. We encountered a different kind of nature, perhaps, and the nature I encountered in Sri Lanka, even though vastly different to that which I encountered in Australia, was very much in animal reserves, in Yala and Wilpattu, set apart from human encroachment, etc. So it was already a kind of nature that had been impinged upon by various eras of colonialism and land management and human population. And of course, when we come to Australia, we encounter a very different kind of idea of wilderness and nature. So this is the sort of overall scene I was sort of conjuring as I was first starting to read your book. And I thought that might be a useful place to start.
Yeah, two things about it. One is that, of course, in Australia, in South Africa, you have a settler colonial nature, because really it's in settler colonial societies where Europeans think that they have a huge land reserve. They think that the indigenous people are small populations living off huge amounts of land. So land can be zoned into, you know, natural reserves and human habitations. And so it's very much settler colonial management of managed nature that you find. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even the pristine forests in Tasmania and other places are there only because humans allow them to exist. Yeah. These are human decisions. Humans mm-hmm. could have decided not to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So even the pristine forests exist at human mercy. My exposure to nature was very much the settler colonial nature that you encounter in the mm-hmm. settler colonial society, but I still found it very beautiful.
I sense that your encounter with Anthropocene hypothesis emerges from an affective relationship with that encounter with nature. Do you want
with that encounter with fire, which destroyed nature spots I loved.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one affective part of it, the sense of bereavement I talked about. But there's also another thing, at the same time, a kind of sense of discovery that humans had become a geological agent. That was kind of an intellectual mm-hmm. Discovery as well, because normally you separated the geological from the human mm-hmm. in terms of scales and, you know, just as, I mean, you know that evolutionary biologists talk about large swaths of time, pre-human time, geologists talk about that. So as such, these are not new knowledges, mm-hmm. but then to connect human activities that take place over human scales of time to changes over planetary scales of time, that was new.
Mm-hmm.
That connection mm-hmm. was new for me. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me thinking. So there was both a sense of bereavement and a sense of intellectual excitement. Mm-hmm. Like when your frameworks don't seem to work as well as they did.
Yes.
You know, and I always think there are two kinds of intellectuals. There are intellectuals who are very invested in saving the frameworks. Every time they get ambushed by the world, they think it's somebody's conspiracy to hoodwink them.
Mm-hmm.
And temperamentally, I don't belong to that camp. Temperamentally, I'm always interested in finding myself to be wrong,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't
mm-hmm.
mean that I don't fight for the belief I have.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, if I think that the data is suggesting overwhelmingly that I'm wrong, I'm happy to prove them wrong, mm-hmm. happy to be proven. But I come across friends who are either so invested in something that they worked out, explained the world for them. Any challenge they think of as a conspiracy to either hoodwink them, take the framework away from them.
Yes.
You know, I've never cathected myself in that kind of way
yeah.
onto a framework.
Yes. And the humanist framework that is currently under challenge, or the one that seems inadequate to deal with this current planetary moment, is what you refer to as a global account, a earthly account.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to get there more slowly, but yes.
So my point is, by challenged, I don't mean completely usurped or completely found out to be untrue. What I mean is, you know, when the framework with which you explain the world seems to fall short of what you empirically begin to know about the world. For instance, if you're a Marxist today and firmly believe that capitalism led to global warming, suppose you do, there's nothing wrong with that, you would still have to think about the role of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to still have to learn something about what methane does. You'll still have to know something about what we mean by heat trapping gases.
Mm-hmm.
Would still find out these are trace gases in the atmosphere. They don't occupy a large space in the atmosphere. Then if you're curious, you might want to think, how come these small gases are able to warm up the planet, small amounts? Mm-hmm. That will take you to know something about the molecular structure of these gases and what kind of heat they trap and why. So it takes you beyond the normal repertoire of Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
right? To deal with sciences, to deal with what you might call a system science, a planetary science. And in that sense, I'm saying that even if you were a strong Marxist and thought that this is all the work of capitalism, in order to understand what the fault is, you would need to stretch yourselves. To my Marxist friends, I often say it's a Marxism plus problem.
Yes, clearly not an abandonment of Marxist critiques or indeed post-colonial critiques, because the other dimension of confronting a planetary epoch, and we have to come to talking about the whole issue of scale and the very problem of the comprehensibility of human time compared to planetary time. And you spend a great deal of space in the book, and I think an extremely evocative discussion in discussing this very challenging problem of the difference between human scales of time and the planetary scales of time. But the Marxist and post-colonial critiques of capitalism, of empire and imperialism, of settler colonialism are not abandoned, but we are led to confront new political issues, I think is a sort of starting point of the book. And you take your bearings from Hannah Arendt's work in The Human Condition and also Carl Schmitt's work in The Nomos of the Earth. But there is a sort of terrestrial and earthly dimension to these two thinkers coming at the end, really sort of writing The Human Condition and The Nomos of the Earth are written roughly at the same time, within a few years of each other in the 1950s. And the Anthropocene hypothesis, of course, refers to the Great Acceleration. And there is this significant new knowledge about anthropogenic climate change created by human consumption, modes of production, and movement of peoples. But yet there's a critique, of course, that the retort that post-colonial Marxist and other thinkers make, which is to say, you know, largely this is a problem of industrialization, of the age of empire. This is not a problem that is being created by the vast majority of the world's population. And you address that question and that provocation from these critics.
There's no question that industrialization, empires, it's part of the history of capitalism, both of them. And they also lead to modernization programs, the use of fossil fuel. There are many ways to cut this cookie. There are geologists who say that humans became exceptional in the animal world when the hominins learned to manage fire, because that was the first time a biological species had available to it more energy than its muscles could generate. So there are geologists who argue for an ancient Anthropocene going back to pre-human hominins, then a kind of middle Anthropocene, then a more recent Anthropocene, and these are geologists who say that the Anthropocene should not be formalized.
Yes.
But just kept as an informal category. The people who are arguing that the beginning of the Anthropocene is the beginning of the Great Acceleration from the 1950s, but argue from certain empirical basis, one of which is that 87% of the fossil fuel humans have used have been used after 1950. People don't realize that most of the electricity in India, around Bombay and places, in the colonial period came from water. It's only after independence that the use of coal goes up. It's really the Cold War period, the reconstruction of the OECD countries, the decolonization and the emergence of new nations following some modernization projects from Egypt to India to Indonesia. Then the liberalization of China and India in the late 1980s and early 1990s results in a situation where what is called Great Acceleration really becomes steeper. There's some statistics showing that if around 2000, the bulk of the consumers of the world came from the usual suspect OECD countries, North Atlantic and Japan, now the bulk of the consumers come from China, South Asia, Latin America, the new middle classes of Africa. They constitute 70% of consumers. Today's fish supply, 90% comes out of Asia, the bulk of it from China. So there have been substantial changes in this last 70 years, which includes the rise of new middle classes. And that's not just empires and
Western
capitalism.
So there's sort of post-colonial carbon, you could say.
Well, it's post-colonial and post, you might call neoliberal carbon. Mm-hmm. It's also post-Reagan and Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
You can't think of Chinese industrialization without thinking of American deindustrialization. The decision in the Anglo economies that they're going to kind of send capital overseas to work cheap labor, right? And China more or less followed the Singapore path of going from a cheap wage economy to high wage economy,
mm-hmm.
which is something that India can't do. I mean, Indians have found out that the model is not infinitely replicable.
Mm-hmm.
They're pulling out of that. It's really, so in some ways, Asian Anthropocene going forward is going to be a large part of what you're calling the Anthropocene.
Yes.
Right? So similarly, Latin American. So in that sense, the more telling part of the story is really post-1950. As I said, if you are a geologist who wants to begin with the management of fire, it goes very far back.
Mm-hmm.
If you're somebody who wants to begin the story with the invention of agriculture or the emergence of agriculture, yes, you know, then the colonization of Latin America. So there are all these dates on the table as to when does it start.
Yes, yes.
But so in my book, instead of getting caught up in this controversy that I can't settle, I don't have the skills to, I'm not a stratigrapher, I look at the evidence that amassed, and it's very clear that the great acceleration thesis is true. In sociology, Hartmut Rosa has written about this from a different point of view, not from a climate point of view. So that the world was accelerating was being noticed in other disciplines. Steve Pinker notes it with satisfaction that humans are living, you know, better and better, and more of them. The other interesting fact, again, produced by Hoover Institution research, shows that the first 1 billion of human number for human consumers was reached in 1986. Now we are about 4 billion going on to 5. 3 billion human beings live in absolute misery. But the number of humans who are actually better off than they were and are aspirational, want to consume more, that's increased.
Just to not lose the key term that I think captures what you're saying about the Asian Anthropocene and so forth, this is part of, I suppose, a continuation of your work to, as you have with provincializing Europe, to also provincialize the Anthropocene.
Yeah, provincialize the Anthropocene, not necessarily in Kathleen Morrison's sense. I mean, Kathy was saying, yes, of course, why blame only the West? But she was also trying to talk about it as an archaeologist or a prehistorian of the cultivation of rice. But she...
The use of fire to kill megafauna and so forth.
All of that sort of stuff. Mm. But Lala Suvich, again, these are the facts are not at controversy.
I think
either you pick a date that conforms to the bias of your training or appeals to it, or you pick a date because you're a stratigrapher and you think the stratigraphic evidence is overwhelming. That's why I moved away from the Anthropocene debate to arguing that we are beyond the global.
Yes.
As a historian, if I had to name the age, I would say the coming age is planetary. We've become planetary. And that, to me, seemed a defensible proposition and something I could defend as a historian.
Let's move on to talking about the planetary. But just before that, I wanted to also just say, I mean, you say the Anthropocene can remain informal. Do you use it as a metaphor?
When I first used it, I used it in the way that many people used it, which is a term that signaled the extent of the impact humans were having on the planet. You couldn't even name a geological epoch after humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was my first take. The second take, which is there in the chapter called Anthropocene Time, is when I became interested in the nature of geological time.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually also a term that is trying to talk about time, not just impact. Evidence, the working group on Anthropocene amassed, is really also the evidence of impact, like how much earth do we move around?
Mm-hmm.
how broiler chicken is now the most popular bird on the planet, right? I mean, those yes. are historical
that
facts.
the bones of broiler chicken will be found right. in the geological structure in thousands of years, yeah, etc. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So then moving to characterizing this difference between, let's say, global accounts of the human condition and the planetary, one of the phenomenological problems you encounter is that this is a claim being made about species being, in a sense, that the planetary impact is an impact that a species is having, even though this species can't really have a sense of itself as a species. That's one of the challenges that you grapple with in the book.
Yeah, initially, of course, yeah, that was a challenge. One is to make a distinction, I think, between species and species being, because species being was a more philosophical expression that Marx used in discussing Feuerbach and discussing alienation. So the being of the species was something that the human species was going to kind of re-realize, recapture through the communist movement. Whereas in biological use of the term species, there is no being. There's no particular nature. There's no ontology.
Yes.
So I'm using species in the biological sense rather than
right.
in Marx.
Right. I see. Yeah. Okay.
So I began, yes, arguing that the species is in the E.O. Wilson sense, that we have become a dominant species. But what I've come to realize more, and I think in the later chapters of the book, I say it without necessarily signaling the transition, is that it's not just human domination of life. It's actually humans, the animals we keep, either to eat or we just keep them, and the institutions we need, the technology, the institutions we need to farm animals, to keep ourselves alive. These three things almost form a complex that dominates the order of life. So it's not just humans alone. Humans, in order to become dominant, have had to also produce cows and fish and sheep in much larger numbers than the world would have produced left to itself. So in a way, they've been pressuring the biosphere to produce more for human consumption. So there are two things I'm saying. It's not just that humans are consuming more and more. They're actually pressuring the biosphere to produce more so that they can consume more. That's the use of artificial fertilizers. That's the factory farming of chickens. That's the factory farming of cows. See, and this problem came on in the 70s, early on, as a problem of animal rights. So if you look at Peter Singer's book on animal liberation, he actually shows the very sharp increase in the number of cattle that we were actually farming. He was focused on the cruelty aspect of it. But this was already great acceleration. And the fact, the reason why I again come back to Asia and the new middle class is that it's a, whether you like it or not, it's a demonstrated fact that when humans come into money, they want to eat more protein. So the world has to supply that protein. And that's why we have industrialization of other forms of life, because without that, if you didn't farm animals, if you didn't farm fish, then, and if you call that condition natural, the natural condition, then the biosphere in its natural condition would not produce enough protein for us.
Well, that, I mean, the level of protein and the source of protein, of course, I mean, it's arguable that there's an overconsumption of protein. And also, then this sort of brings me to the relationship between what you're describing as the multiplication of the number of animals and bio-life, which has been brought about, of course, by human agency, human institutions, human agricultural methods, fertilizers, etc., and where the ethical responsibility lies in relation to this. And this, of course, relates to a question of justice. So we might, for example, and I would assert that as soon as possible, but certainly within the next two decades, we need to get to a place where the eating of animals, if not completely eliminated, must become an ethically abhorrent thing. In the same way that, for example, we have not eliminated racism, but explicit racism or sexism would be regarded as politically or ethically abhorrent. Now, to get to that place of raising human consciousness, to accept that reality of the impact of human consumption on the planet, we need to be able to situate responsibility for this current planetary moment that you're grappling with the humans. But at the same time, we're also dealing with this multiplication of biological life. So there is a, in a sense, when you move from the global, to take it back to that kind of meta narrative, you move from the global to the planetary, we're still sitting, if you like, with the human in the driver's seat.
Okay, there are 2 points. Let me first of all point out something that's rhetorically is interesting about your formulation. And it's not just yours. I mean, when rhetorically somebody proposes a we from the right wing, we are immediately quick to puncture the we and see difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When from the left we propose an ethical proposition saying we must, we will, we should, we never question that we. We assume that such a we can, mm-hmm. somehow the we of the left is more realizable than the we of the right. And I proceed from the Carl Schmittian proposition, which is also Hannah Arendt's proposition, that politics is grounded on difference. There is no we. There's the figure of the we that hovers on this problem. Besides, a very acute conundrum, because the moment you think about the problem, some figure of the we pops up.
Mm-hmm.
We should do this, we should do that. But the moment you try to think of that we politically, you see several positions. You see the Marxists hoping somehow that a collective rational we can be produced that will be persuaded by all argument. And I think the historical evidence is that humanity becomes one only in very exceptional circumstances. Politics is grounded in difference. Politics is grounded in difference of opinion, outlook. And you have to negotiate those differences. So it's possible that one day somewhere in the world, one state, one government may actually back this policy. It's also possible that a disaster might force us to accept a reality like that, right? But to think you can theoretically say that, look, this looks like an ethical requirement of the times. And I wouldn't agree with that. But the difference between that kind of a logical derivation of an ethic and the realization of ethic on the part of the majority of human beings, that's where the field of politics is.
Mm-hmm. But the second point, you said there are 2 points.
The second point is, morally, there's nothing wrong with humans wanting to live well. If you bracketed the question of the biosphere, the earth, all of that stuff. Which is why when the question of the earth was not so much in front of our eyes, if you go back to the 50s and 60s and look at the development literature, in fact, Sri Lanka was often complimented on being more developed on those indices than the rest of South Asia, educational. I mean,
yes, education, agriculture, and so on. Yeah.
If you took us back to the 50s, the current crisis of Sri Lanka would be unthinkable.
Yes, yes.
Right? Because we all saw societies on the same trajectory, moving up, and in many respects, Sri Lanka occupied the place that Bangladesh has occupied sometimes more in more recent discussions about having good sort of quality life. Taking myself there, I still find that Amartya Sen kind of argument about human well-being, capacity to choose, all of those things are quite unassailable. So long as humans don't pursue the good life in such a way that it actually imperils the possibility of enjoying the good life. Now that's the conundrum, therefore, is where do humans go from here? And I see the fork represented by two Harvard intellectuals. One is David Keith, who is a physicist trying to produce technology for climate engineering, geoengineering, and has a book defending the idea. And the other one is Edward Wilson, who was saying humans should scale back. I mean, humans have found out that they're planetary. They should scale back. And there, your arguments about, yes, we need protein, but what kind of protein? Are we over-consuming? Could we do with a rational distribution of protein? Those kind of questions come back. My book just inhabits the fork. It doesn't tilt either way. I try not to. Because I think because politics is based on disagreement, I leave it to people who are more political than I am to fight it out. But so long as both parties understand that we become planetary. So that's what I was trying to create as a pre-hyphen political space of thinking, not abandoning politics, but trying to extract out of all the political demands that are couched in terms of urgency, a thought space where we give ourselves, that the thinkers give themselves enough space to realize what becoming planetary is. And the book was written in aid of developing the distinction, explaining the planetary by explaining both its relationship to and its difference from the global. Because I argue that it's an intensification of global capitalism that brings the planetary into our everyday domain by becoming news item. It's becoming news item. That's its relationship, but it is, but what comes into view is not something that is just global.
Okay, so I mean, that's really helpful, Dipesh. Thank you for explaining that. And when you were saying the pre-political, and I saw reference to that in the book as well explicitly, I think towards the latter part of the book. And I was thinking, yes, I was thinking as you were speaking, well, what is the other pre-political example? And of course, would it be sort of Hobbes's State of Nature? That, of course, that is also an imagined hypothetical place, because of course when you are charting this fork in the road, as you put it, it's not that we're not in a political space. And in fact, you yourself said, where do we go from here, before you introduced David Keith and Edward Wilson. So there is a kind of we, whether that is a we of academic disciplines, of historians, of humans, let's say. And I also wanted to remark, when you were speaking earlier, I think in the concept of the political, Schmidt says, you know, anyone who invokes the human or humanity is lying. I think he says that in a footnote in the concept of the political. So the sort of striation, the differentiation of the human that we might talk about as protein consumers or animal eaters, right, and so on, right, needs to be a nuanced and differentiated one. I take that point. But then, you know, the other aspect of the fork in the road is the realization that the level of impact that humans are having on planetary systems and so forth is quite catastrophic. Now, and in another planetary register, one could say, well, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because in the broader space of planetary time, one that we humans cannot actually grapple with, you know, we can grapple with the period of the Holocene or the interglacial periods, because there's a certain kind of human history that could be told about agriculture and the emergence of empires and so on. But we cannot fathom millions and billions of years. And in the scheme of millions and billions of years of geological time, our troubles here, this conversation about politics, perhaps matters very little. So there is that aspect of grappling with the planetary that you also tackle in the book that I'd like us to come to.
So, you know, the book was, I saw it, and I say it, tries to imagine a new philosophical anthropology. Having started with the collapse of the natural history, human history distinction, then I go on to say that we are on the cusp of the global and the planetary. And the planetary, for me, creates a perspective from which a new philosophical anthropology can begin, because it decenters the human. So humans will have to engage in whatever it is that they call the political with two views of themselves. One is the familiar human that is capable of feeling wronged. You know, I mean, the capacity to feel wronged is much stronger in humans than the capacity to be just. I mean, we feel injustice more strongly than we actually are prepared to give justice to people. So I define justice negatively as the capacity to feel wronged rather than the capacity to correct wrongs. In that sense, Derrida's, you know, justice is always something to come, appeals to me very powerfully. So that's the familiar human. The feelings of being wronged are not false feelings. They're real feelings. Phenomenologically, we know they exist and they should be addressed. And the other human, what the planet tells us, is that we are not the end that the planet had in view in evolving itself to be a habitable planet. And the example I give is of oxygen in the air, which has been maintained in the roughly in the present proportions for 375 million years. So even if we were not here, the oxygen would be here to service other animals, other forms of life. So humans are themselves a provincial project, which now acts as though this was the project of God. We are not a special project of God. And therefore, the human exceptionalism is what I was challenging. And therefore, I think whatever we do out of the first way of being human, global, in aid of justice, social justice, whatever, gender justice, sexual justice, whatever we do, racial justice, we should do it. Again, I'm talking about we. And I know that this we will not, won't happen. But as an ethical statements can't be made without...
Yeah, we can have ethical horizons, no? We can...
Ethical horizons. And one horizon there would be to keep that in mind, that we are a limited form of life. We are a minority form of life. If we dominate the order of life, we do so at our own peril. Philosophically, and to the degree that I can think practically, I'm more with Edward Wilson, you know, of scaling back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more with my geologist friends, you know, Zalasevich and Mark Williams, who've written a book on biosphere, where basically they argue that if we really want to have sustainable cities, since we are becoming a city-dwelling species, sustainable cities that actually work with the logic of habitability, then all our technology would have to be biodegradable. Your computer will have to be biodegradable. And it's a very tall ask, right? But that, to me, shows the conundrum that we have reached. And sometimes I feel people who blame it on capitalism, they don't realize the depth of the conundrum. Even if Marxists took over the planet, they would still have to help 8 billion people survive. And 8 billion people, half of whom, more than half, since 2007, have been living in cities. To convert these cities, which are all parasitic, the cities produce waste that can't be recycled. To convert these cities into ecological spaces, not in this digital imagination of smart cities that the capitalists champion. It's a horrendous task. I mean, I see the beginnings of it. Like in Sydney, for instance, there are projects of this has begun to happen in other cities. City agriculture, right? Growing vegetables on pavements in the green patches, growing stuff on buildings, you know, not just rooftops, but on the edges of windows and things. We will reimagine cities, reimagine technology. But the current solutions are more in terms of, you know, just focusing on source of energy. So get lithium batteries, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 40% of the lithium in the world, I think, comes from Chile. And American dreams of green technology is based on Chilean.
Yeah, lithium. Of course. It's a new colonial frontier frontier. Yeah.
I have friends in Chile who work on bacterial formation in the lithium mine. And they show how it's destroying, mining lithium is destroying the bacterial world, which is then having an impact on flamingos that used to come. Mm-hmm. Eat the bacteria. And the bacteria is so thick. I mean, you can actually, in ordinary photographs, see red bands over white. Mm-hmm. The red bands are the bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the lithium battery, people don't think about these problems. Yeah. It's a profound conundrum because we are inhabiting structures that were created to help popularize fossil fuel technology. And we are trying to slowly transition from these structures into the use of renewables and things. And that time of transition probably will not match carbon budget calendars that IPCC gives out. So when I participated in discussions on solutions, I find that most practical solutions are piecemeal. And the totalizing solutions, like get rid of capitalism, get rid of modernity, are unpractical. It's not a problem to which we have a perfect solution. That's why the argument that we should think of both mitigation and adaptation. Help people who are really going to be damaged more, the poor people, people exposed because of geographical reasons and other factors to the ravages of, you know, climate change events. Prepare for the disasters we can predict. I mean, those are the practical measures that for which we can put pressures on government policymakers. Like, for instance, where you have to compensate victims of extreme floods or extreme fires. These are legitimate social questions that societies can discuss. You know, how should the burden be distributed?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How should the burden of the third world be distributed? Like, should there be pressure on rich countries to transfer technology cheaply? There's a practical question of how much pressure you can bring on rich countries. It's a practical question. There, I think the ethical propositions publicly voiced at COP meetings and things, they help, because at least they shame people. How much the West will actually be shamed, who knows? You know, I mean, the West has been quite brutally selfish when it has wanted to. Same with India and China. They can be brutally selfish too. These I don't have an answer for. The book was trying to simply say, just understand that we become planetary.
Reaching that understanding that we have become planetary involves, for us humans, in terms of coming to terms with ourselves, telling stories. And I think in different registers, you tell wonderful stories. You tell stories that physicists would say or that biologists would say. And you also draw on various poets, Rabindranath Tagore, for example, and other modern and modernist thinkers. Immanuel Kant features heavily as a crucial modern register. Kierkegaard is another, and Heidegger, of course. And all of these figures see the human as a kind of destination. I think there is this wonderful part of the book where you talk about each of these figures going somewhere to which is a favorite place for them, and they look at the world from this
landscapes.
Yes, so yeah. So they look at the landscape, they look at nature from a particular place. And I became very conscious of the fact that I do that myself. It's perhaps many people do that. It's a place where you go for special reflection, and often it involves
renewing yourself, spiritually renewing yourself.
Absolutely. To renew, to also to remember, because by returning, you also recall the old self that was there before. But one of the elements that happens, or one of the things that happens, and I think it's in the story about Kierkegaard, is that nature seems to recede. When you're, so there are maybe some birds flying around, but it really becomes very much about the self, a very self-centered narrative. And for Tagore and for Kant in particular, the human is a destination. Now, that is something that is a sort of modern imaginary that I think you say we need to depart from as we confront the planetary.
Yes, when I was writing that section, Bruno Latour said to me something. I'm quoting him from conversation.
Uh-huh.
I think I'd sent him a draft chapter or something. He'd read it and we were discussing. And he said to me, Dipesh, but this world that Tagore and others talk about, it's so empty. It doesn't have enough creatures in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The soil looks like soil. It doesn't see the life in the soil. And I thought he was so right. When you think of landscape as a resource for renewing yourself spiritually, the landscape itself becomes very empty. It's a form of the infinite that you face. And it's very much a theological relationship in a secular form, like I and thou that Martin Buber talks about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For Tagore, it's very much I and thou. This infinite is some presence of God. And when Bruno said to me that it's very empty, it really struck a chord. I thought he's so right. The reason we don't see this as empty is because also there's a question of human time arises in the fact of return, that we return to this place. My parents may have gone to this place. So over a few hundred years, we expect this place, or a few thousand years, we expect these places to hold. I mean, Sanskrit literature, which is not more than, let's say, 2,000 years old or 2.5, most of it sort of less than that. Sanskrit literature describes India as being bounded by the Himachal, the Himalayas on the top and the seas at the bottom. While geologically, the Himalayas are a recent incident.
Mm-hmm.
They're a young mountain. And you see the popular use of it in tour guide books. Say, oh, you're going to Barcelona, visit this beach. But when you learn to see like a geologist, then you see these landscapes as results of cataclysmic processes. And you see a very restless planet. The kind of calm serenity that you can ascribe to this landscape, these sites, is precisely because your time on this planet is so small. If humans could live for 12,000 years, they would see how restless the planet is.
Yes, yes.
I mean, this spirituality wouldn't arise. You would have a very different theory.
The special place would disappear because of some geological
just
event.
Yes, exactly, too quickly. So that's what, in a way, I was trying to say, is that when you when you can think like a geologist, you think very differently. You don't think out of the premise of human experience. And it's a special training they give themselves, evolutionary biologists, you know. And the more you read them, talk to them, you can imbibe some of that imagination. And then you begin to see how much this is a function of the shortness of our lifespans.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in human terms, we've doubled our lifespans. Mm. So part of the book was trying to create this anthropology that would provincialize the human, as it were. Again, I was reacting to things I've read in colleagues' writing, like Martha Nussbaum in Frontiers of Justice. She may not have this view now, but there's a line where she was visualizing this world as covered with human justice. She had this image of a tiger in humanly just world, not being allowed to hunt anymore, because that would be cruelty to other animals, but being provided with toys on which it would take out its aggression. And I thought, that's what I was resisting. Humanity is a limited project. Human justice is a limited project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are viruses that eat bacteria in the oceans, and they keep some balance between bacteria and viruses by eating these bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no justice. I mean, the bacteria that gets eaten can't come to a court and say, we feel wronged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think feeling wronged itself is an evolved capacity in some animals. We are one of those. So I was responding to those kind of statements in Martha's philosophy of justice.
Yes.
She was trying to extend human justice to animals. So she was trying to say, we must not try to take aggression out of tigers, because that's their nature. We could ensure in a human managed world that this was taken out on, toys made of plastic. But then you keep the animate inanimate distinction so strong.
Yes.
And you don't think of where the rubber or other stuff is going to come
Absolutely.
From.
Absolutely, yes. And something about the tiger being, or the species being of the tiger, is compromised there. I'll come back to this theme, but before I do that, I wanted to just dwell for a moment and recall Bruno Latour, who we lost recently, and my commiserations to you. It's very obvious from the book and the interview at the back of the book that you were very close, and it's an enormous loss to everybody, I'm sure, to his friends, but of course to those who didn't know him. I think I only saw him give a couple of lectures, and they have stayed with me, even though they were probably, 10 or 15 years ago. And he helps you, I think, to open what you call vistas of deep time, because he, throughout his work, decentered the human and focused on a wider landscape of actors.
And also reading geologists, reading earth system scientists.
Yes.
And reading evolutionary biologists like Edward Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the geologists I knew, like Zalasevich, also became a very good friend.
Yes, yes.
And he would keep sending me drafts of his own or copies of his own article that I wouldn't have been able to find otherwise. So he was educating me. In the same way that Latour was educating me. And the other person who was educating me in some ways was François Hartog.
Uh-huh. Yes.
His interest in regimes of historicity. And Clive Hamilton, who was himself working on climate change and geoengineering. And I learned a great deal from his work too.
And Jan Zalasiewicz, who's many propositions you consider, but particularly his notion of geological time being simply time. I think compared to a sort of human historical time being filled with hope and despair and a range of affective elements, Zalasiewicz talks about geological time as simply time. And I think that juxtaposition of historical time and planetary time is important.
Yeah. I mean, there was two interesting things I learned from there, from Zalasiewicz and others, is that while geological time is simply time, there is no geological time without geological objects.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unlike mathematical time,
mm-hmm.
which could exist without any objects.
Yes.
Secondly, also that,
You should explain that a bit further about the need for an object, which is to say, I mean, this is what stratigraphers are also dealing with.
Yeah, and geological time comes without the story of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
There's no geological time. So when you say, when was the universe created, or when was the solar system created? created. You're talking about these objects, the sun, the planet.
Right.
It's precisely because the planet exists that the question of stratigraphy exists. The question of fossil evidence or proxy fossil evidence, all of those things are central. But and as I say, going back to Augustine, that huge swathes of time also carry some affect for us.
Mm-hmm.
But often not the affect of despair or hope, not the sense of urgency. But see, there's another question during the time which I touch on in the book. Again, I don't bring it up. There's just too many things going on in the book in some ways, because if I were to write the book now, I'd probably write it differently. The other question was this debate between about Kant, that Meyasu started.
Mm-hmm.
This question about whether everything is correlated to what humans can see, or is geology also about what is human independent?
So
his point being that the Earth would have been 4.5 billion years old, even if there were no humans.
Yes.
To state that, to say that. I'm often a thinker of the and rather than of the or. So I kind of think in some context I'm a Kantian, in some context I'm a Meyasu. I mean, I think it's the human brain that's producing two ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Why should I as a human being not take advantage of both?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas sometimes there are humans who say, if you say one, then you contradict yourself by saying the second one.
Yes.
But, you know, my undergraduate major was in physics. And once you realize that Einstein was true, even if you followed Newtonian calculations. So you walk into a room and Einstein is true, that your movement into the room bends that room. But it bends it to such an infinitesimal of degrees that for our purposes, you don't notice it, you don't feel it. It's beyond phenomenology.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you read even undergraduate physics, you know that there's the phenomenal world that Newtonian physics addresses. And this phenomenal world then has sides, aspects to it, which are not within phenomenological grasp. Not everything is correlated in that sense to human perceptual scheme. And being able to keep both quantum physics and Newtonian classical physics in your head means that you are able to live in contradiction, A and B. I normally don't think in terms of A or B. It's a strange thing that it's only within humanities, you know, truth cannot be often proven in the scientific way, that people become extremely intolerant of each other's views.
Yes. Like it's a humanist trait.
You would think that the fact that we can't really prove our propositions in a compelling manner, like in a Euclid-like fashion, would make us tolerant of somebody else mm-hmm. who's thinking differently. But the opposite often happens.
Now, this is a wonderful explanation, and I'm conscious that you've given me so much of your time. I'll try to just pull it together with a couple of final questions. One is the importance of mutuality, which mm-hmm. I think you've just touched on. It's a problem very much of human finitude, but it also may well be, as you put it via Meyasu, that the geological structures and the planetary objects would exist even if the human wasn't around to be conscious of it. So there is a different order of mutuality that poses. And if you come through that terrain of ideas, and you're also posing the question of what is the new notion of the political for a planetary age, right? That invokes a different set of questions about mutuality of beings who are conscious of a different order of finitude, right? So there's the sort of finitude of, can I be conscious of my own mortal life without witnessing the mortality of others, something that Jean-Luc Nancy develops in his work. And then there's the larger question of human finitude as a species, as having a particular kind of social system, institutional structures, processes of justice, and so on.
Human finitude, purely in terms of lifespan, is an old problem in many cultures. Like the Greeks think of mortality and immortality. The gods are immortal. Humans are mortal. So the whole Prometheus myth has to do with stealing the fire of Zeus, right?
Mm.
And there's so, but again, if you come to Upanishads, if you come to Buddhism, it's the same problem. Why does death happen? Why do we die? Augustine complicates it by creating God as eternal, beyond mortality and immortality. But the question of that finitude has always existed for humans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for, when I say always, at least, I mean for recorded history. But even when you go back to see archaeological remains of, in Australia, of Aboriginal death rituals,
mm-hmm.
death has meant something to humans. Particularly because, we are kind of animals where children need rearing for a long time. So affection is very important for us between an older person and a young person. Humans developed, among the primates, humans developed 3-generation families, which the chimps don't even have yet.
Mm,
mm. We've had that for thousands of years. Our capacity for affection and attachment is very powerful and strong. So that has been a human theological, philosophical question, articulated, not articulated, but there for a long time. The other thing about finitude I think of is what I now call the process of making finite,
mm-hmm.
the planet. The planet undergoes a process of being made finite. So there was mm-hmm. a time when humans could invest the planet with a degree of infiniteness. Like that, like, you know, Kant says in the Perpetual Peace essay, I think, that because we live on a globe, we have to get on with each other.
Mm-hmm.
If we lived on a flat surface, we could just do without each other. Right?
Right, right.
But in that mode of thinking, people came to think that finitude was an absolute attribute of the planet. It's round, so it's finite.
Mm-hmm.
Or even when the Club of Rome report says there can't be infinite economic growth on a finite planet, finitude is seen as an attribute of the planet. But I see actually the world becomes more and more finite the more humans can sort of impact it. If we develop a capacity, so for instance, we have developed a capacity to, let's say, grow more meat
mm-hmm.
or more rice. And the planet says to us, you know, like in the language of, let's say, an Indian servant, say, okay, boss, I'll produce more meat, but I'll also produce more methane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's how it. So the production of methane in either rice cultivation or in producing more meat tells you that the planet cannot go on producing more meat without producing more methane. So the cost aspect of the benefits become more and more visible. And that's the process of being made finite.
Mm-hmm.
That's a relation
mm-hmm.
where finitude is a relational concept. I can yeah. seem infinite at one point, I can then seem finite at another point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think humans have made the planet more finite. That's how the encounter with the finitude of the world has happened.
Mm-hmm.
By becoming more extractive, by becoming more demanding
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of it.
Well, Dipesh, this is an extremely rich philosophical anthropology that you have given us. There is so much more to talk about in the book, to contemplate. I'm sure, as I have been doing, there will be reading groups studying this book now and for years to come. I thank you for the generosity of your time joining me on Countersign. And I look forward to future work that you will do on this and other topics. Thank you so much.
I look forward to meeting you sometime.
Yes, thank you, Dipesh.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.